I know you will understand this and feel the intrinsic and incredible emotion. You have just pulled over your head the worn, warm sweater belonging to a boy. Now you haven't had a passionate kissing session or anything, but you got to go on a camping trip with him and 8 other people from school. And you practically slept together, your sleeping bag right next to his. And you woke in the night to watch him as he slept, but you couldn't see anything because it was dark, so you just lay there and listened to his breathing and wondered if your heart might burst. The sweater has that slightly goat-like smell which all teenage boys possess, and that smell will lovingly transfer to all your other clothes.
Say it. Linoleum knife. In the middle of that, first of all, I didn't know what that was at the beginning until she started
speaking.
And in the midst of hearing the song again after, you know, it's like song's like 20 years old.
Yeah.
I thought to myself, whatever happened to
Maren Cadell?
Maren Cadell. Well, he lives in Canada.
FTM?
Yeah.
Wow, really?
That's the Wikipedia information. The Wikipedia page. Bless you.
Thank you. Because Maren used to be a lesbian, I remember.
The Wikipedia page says Maren Cadell is a Canadian writer and performance artist. He is an assistant professor of song lyrics and libretto writing in the creative writing program at University of British Columbia. He transitioned in 2003. Most of his recordings were released between 1988 in 1997. Fascinating.
And is Maren still named Maren? That was always sort of an ambiguous name.
Sort of a generically could be either gender name anyway.
Right.
So, yeah.
Fascinating. I had no idea.
Ah, dude. Huh. No.
That was, if you want to hear the rest of that spoken word piece.
I didn't know anything about what happened to Maren Cadell after that song because it was like this novelty, alternative radio novelty song in the early 90s.
Anyway, so if you go to YouTube, and I'm sure if you put in Merincadell and sweater, you can hear the whole song, which is kind of a hoot. And I chose it because...
Why did you choose it?
Because it's October. It's like towards the end of October.
And yeah, so?
We're starting to get some a little touch of autumn crispness even here in Southern California.
Even in Los Angeles, yeah.
So it's a song about a sweater. It seemed like it was...
What's that got to do with anything?
It's sweater weather.
Not yet. Not here anyway.
For most of the civilized Northern Hemisphere world, it is.
Oh, check it out. Okay, so like there's the picture of y'all can't see this.
But I can't see it. What do you?
There's the picture of Maren Cadell in the ladied past.
Right.
And now here is a picture of Maren Cadell as he exists today.
Yeah, well, good for him.
Huh.
Well played, Maren Cadell.
I'm fascinated by this now. I have to go investigate more things.
Well, let's do a show first. What do you say?
You do a show. I'm busy.
Your face is busy.
There's a little meme-y looking thing. It says, a former fixture of the Toronto arts scene and made famous by the sweater, Maren Cadell, is now a university professor living as a man and the happiest he's ever been.
Good for him.
That was a... Is that how you say it? You say it living as a man? I mean,
living as a man implies that he's a drag king. If he transitioned, then he's a man. That's
you're
it.
Like a, you're, I mean, do people say
I'm living as a man, I
Chaz
suppose.
Chaz Bono is living as a man now? Or do we just say Chaz Bono is a man?
I believe the correct would be to say is a man. If any listeners have opinions on this sort of thing, feel free
to
do
we have any trans listeners? Who would know the answers
maybe.
To how to say things properly?
Maybe. We have trans friends, and maybe some of them listen to this show.
None of our actual friends listen to this show. Have you ever noticed that? None of our local friends are like, so blah, blah, blah on the podcast. No. They're like, yeah, we don't listen.
Some of them do.
Who listens?
Hensley listens.
Dennis listens.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
For one. I think Aaron listens.
Who else?
He?
Does Aaron listen?
Does he?
You better be listening to Aaron.
I know Tom Ford listens because he complains about things.
When you'll pay wrong, so, if you're not listening here. Oh, Tom Ford listens?
Yes.
Not the Tom Ford.
No.
Just, I always have, we always have to say that.
Our Tom Ford.
Our Tom Ford. Not the Tom Ford.
Yeah.
What's he got to complain about?
Just not complain. He just,
I know he's got plenty of things to complain about.
Anyway. You're Dave White, film critic for movies.com.
Yes. You're Alan Zanarelli, movie critic for therap.com, also of What the Flick, which can be seen on the Young Turks Network on YouTube.
Correct.
And as long as you get two credits, I'm also currently super famous right now on KCRW, Los Angeles's biggest national public radio station. I am on the show Unfictional. UN Fictional. You should go to kcrw.org.
And do they, is it,
and listen to me.
Can you get it? Can you download it from iTunes?
Maybe.
We should investigate this.
Yeah. But you could just go type in the URL of kcrw.org.
There's a term nobody uses.
So many URLs out there that you can easily type into a personal computer.
Because my cousin's really into the internet.
With your fingers. And you can listen to me on the old-timey radio telling a story.
It's true.
About, what is my story about? Oh, it's about, the story's about when I was a teenager and my family decided that they were going to become Amway
salesmen. Are you going to play that story for your mom when you go to Dallas next?
Maybe.
She might like that one.
She might like it. You think it's a bummer.
Well, yes.
You think that story's a bummer, and so does my brother, my older brother, Tim. He listened to it, and he was like, yep, just as horrifying as I remember.
Yes. And so, but to the outside observer, it's hilarious.
I don't know. It might be something that my mom doesn't need to listen to because, okay. I mean, it's not a oh my sad childhood story. I think it's a funny story about my family being completely idiotic and failures. Yes, it's about my family being a failure and how they got into Amway for about a year and a half, and it was the most embarrassing thing that maybe has ever happened to my family. And there are a lot of embarrassing things that happened to my family.
There's competition there.
Yeah.
And it's Dave's on that story is on an episode of Unfictional that's called Your Future in Sales.
Right.
So, you can look for it at kcrw.org or maybe it's on iTunes.
It might be on iTunes.
We don't know, but go to Unfictional and see if they've got it. I bet they do. I have a sneaking suspicion they do.
Anyway, I'm so great on that show.
yes, Dave.
And has anyone voted on who's the champion?
Yes, I win.
Linoleum Knife? What are you talking about?
1-0.
Only one person voted?
Yeah, Kurt Holman. And he said that I'm better than you, so meh.
Screw that guy.
Oh, by the way, we haven't mentioned in a while, November 22nd, Dave and I recorded our first DVD commentary.
Oh, yeah.
For the Canadian gay prison exploitation film Caged Men, a.k.a. I'm Going to Get You, Elliot Boy. And that's coming out from Code Red DVD on November 22nd as part of their Maria's something series. I forget. anyway, so pick it up. We had fun doing it. It's a goofy movie.
It's a crazy movie.
Yeah.
Everyone in prison is gay, apparently.
Yes.
And the prison turns you gay.
Right.
And
once you've been turned, you start setting people on fire. It's great.
Pretty much.
Ripped from today's headlines.
The today's headlines of 1968 or 71 or whatever year.
Whatever,
it was
yeah.
Yeah. What movies are we talking about this week?
Martha, Marcy May, Margin Call, and Paranormal Activity, Three Musketeers.
I like it when you're clever.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a curse.
Yeah, it is.
It's a good thing that that we're not talking about Marginalia, which is the other thing I thought of. But anyway, so
what do you want to talk about first? Let's talk about Paranormal Activity last, because
that's the movie people actually saw this weekend.
That's the movie people actually saw this weekend, and it's the movie that it'll be hardest to talk about
without giving
things away. And so we'll probably end up giving a couple things away.
Yes.
Not
huge swaths.
Not huge spoilery bits or anything, but. All right.
All right, we'll start with Margin Call then.
Explain what it's about.
Margin Call is basically, it's set, I guess, sort of the night before the economy collapsed. It's 2008. It's a brokerage firm in New York. There's a bunch of layoffs, and all these people are being escorted from the building. And one of them, Stanley Tucci, hands a little flash drive to his subordinate, Zachary Quinto, and says, "Hey, you know, I've been working on this thing. You might want to take a look at it and be careful." So when the day is done, everybody leaves. Zachary Quinto starts digging out these numbers and starts crunching and putting together graphs and stuff, and realizes, oh crap, like we are well past the point of no return on this thing, and basically we are now out more than what this company is worth in all these worthless mortgage-backed securities.
So it's time to cheat the investors.
Right. So basically what happens is, you know, he calls two people and they call two people, and suddenly like the board of directors are showing up at 2 o'clock in the morning, and Jeremy Irons, who's the head of the company, arrives by helicopter. And they basically realize that come, you know, 9 a.m. when the market opens, they have to just ditch everything and sell it all. Doesn't matter to who, doesn't matter what they say, doesn't matter what it does to the company, doesn't matter what it does to the economy. They just got to ditch all this stuff. It's the only way they're going to survive. And so it's basically what happened at Lehman Brothers.
Right.
And you know, it's, I found it pretty fascinating, actually.
It's a good movie. You know, well made.
I mean, it's like a play.
Well written. It's like a play.
It's very dialogue-y, and it's all, you know, it's one night and it's in pretty much in one building, and.
And the actors are great, and you know, but the thing is that I can't imagine anyone other than a film critic seeing it. Because, first of all, because we have to see it.
Well, yeah.
But... All right. But what person wants to spend money, go out to a theater, to see a fictionalized sort of micro account.
Excuse me.
Of something that they already know happened and is happening to the entire country right now still.
Well, because...
And is such a bummer and so anger-making. Like, if you're going to watch a movie about this... You just watch Inside Job.
Well, yes. Obviously, Inside Job is the more comprehensive thing.
That's the documentary that is actually an even better made film.
It is.
And more compelling. And
I agree.
And
but I think, though, that
and more angry.
But I think that there are a lot of interesting plays and films that are about, like, sort of historical turning points. And
I agree.
Like, when terrible things happen and why.
I agree.
And the thing is, I think what this movie has that Inside Job doesn't is that because it's focusing on these characters and their part in this whole big thing, it allows you to sort of narrow it down from being just this sort of amorphous, horrifying thing that happened to the notion that, no, this was the direct result of people sitting in offices looking at graphs and deciding that they could pull this off. or that it wasn't going to blow up in their faces.
Right.
You know, and it's like, you know, when what Ben was saying.
But I don't want to know that those are people, because I'm not gonna feel anything for them. Well, other than and the movie doesn't wishing that they were dead.
Well, the movie doesn't ask you to like them or empathize with them. You know, it's like Ben was saying on What the Flick this week. He goes, it's not like three shadowy cabal figures sitting in a room going, how can we destroy the economy? No, these are people who just wanted to make money, and they lost sight of the consequences of this way of making money, and they were allowed to do so by government deregulation and whatever else that sort of opened the doors for this sort of craziness.
You make it sound like they just made a mistake.
No, not at all. I mean, this is hubris.
Clarify.
Yeah, this is hubris, but I'm just saying they didn't do it to sink the economy. They did it to make money, and then they screwed up. Or they did something terrible and didn't foresee the consequences well enough.
Right.
So I think people would want to see that. I think people want to see, you know, stuff that is analogous to big events that
I
want to
see
hard to wrap your brain about. And it's a really strong cast, a lot of good people in it, and they're, you know, doing good work. I think people would see
it. I want to see it 20 years from now.
Well,
I want to see it 20 years from now when someone makes a movie about it from a more distanced perspective, because smack dab in the middle, it just makes me want to go be a part of Occupy Wall Street.
Well,
you
then,
know what I'm saying?
But maybe that was part of the point of the film. Maybe it's supposed to get people angry.
Well, yeah. But again, what you've got instead, that's a more substantial, you know, thing is Inside Job.
Yes.
And you just go watch Inside Job.
I agree with you that Inside Job is a better movie, but not everybody is going to want to see Inside Job. But maybe somebody who would never in a million years sit down to watch a documentary, but does want to see the new movie.
Who is that person? Not for anybody listening to this show.
But
if you're listening to this show and you're not going to sit down to watch a documentary, then you don't actually like movies.
All right. But I'm saying in the great out there of this country, there are people who don't want to sit through a documentary, but who would go see the new Demi Moore Stanley Tucci movie and then go, oh my God, this is what happened? I'm going to go occupy Wichita
now.
I'm going
to go see the new Demi Moore Stanley Tucci movie. Honey, let's go out to dinner and then see the new Demi Moore Stanley Tucci film.
I'm just saying, there are names in this movie that will attract people to see it. And maybe if those people didn't see Inside Job or wouldn't see Inside... Okay, again, there are people who like documentaries but probably wouldn't see Inside Job for the same reason that you think nobody wants to see this movie. Like, ugh, I'm broke. I don't want to watch the financial crisis happen again.
I spent a long time not watching Inside
Job for that reason. Yes, you watched it this week. I've been nagging you for a year to watch that movie.
And I realized before I had watched Martin Call, I had to watch Inside Job. Because as much as I know firsthand the effects of this on our very own home.
Yes.
I am so exhausted by all of it that to watch the movie, even though it was going to explain it in a better way than I could have understood just from watching the news and reading as much as I could.
It's like you've been telling
me the whole thing about, like, it's just making me crazy. It's making me so angry, and I can't watch this thing.
You've been telling me to watch The Corporation for years, and I keep thinking I'm going to throw a shoe through the TV screen if I watch this thing.
You will.
So I've been putting it off, but I am going to do it. I'm going to watch
it. That is a documentary. That's a 3-hour documentary.
Yeah.
About how corporations run the world. And I mean the whole world. All the governments. Everything you own, everything you touch, everything you buy, everywhere you go.
Except this show.
Wrong. Because this show only exists through the magic of apples.
That's true.
And iTunes.
True. To talk about movies that, you know, General Electric and News Corp are putting into theaters. Yes, you're right. We're all pawns of the system, Nate White.
So, that's what's up. Margin Call is a good movie that I don't ever need to watch again. Mm-hmm. And I'm not so sure I looked at themovies.com. I was like, how many stars did I give that? I was like 3.5. Cause it's a good movie.
Yeah.
I just don't know that anyone wants to actually look at it.
Well,
yeah.
Let them decide that for themselves.
Yeah. They will.
Yes.
Again, you think anyone pays attention to our opinions? No. They just want to listen to us talk. They just don't. They don't. They're not going. Oh, David Alonso said you should and or should not see blah blah blah. I don't think people.
I think we get,
take our opinions and go. I'm going to use this as a guide to life.
Later when we get to our listener mail segment, I will show you that some people actually do care about our say so. So there. Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene. Why don't you tell them what it's about?
I had almost a nonstop panic attack watching this movie. It's about a young woman who is living on a commune-y kind of farm.
A collective,
yeah. Kind of laid back, chill, hippie farming kind of people. All of them pretty attractive. and then suddenly it's I Spit on Your Grave and she's running through the woods with this shaky horror movie POV.
And a lot of
like, why is she running? What's happening? Why does she have to escape? Like, you don't know what's going on. You don't know why she's running. You don't know why she's all freaked out when one of the people comes to a diner where she's hiding out and he finds her and is like, come home with me now. And she's like, no, later, maybe I'll see you at dinner. You know, like, it's this, I'm just going to continue eating my waffle. You know, like, it's not a, you don't know what's going on. But she runs away from this place and winds up at the fancy rich Connecticut lake house of her sister and brother-in-law. And apparently she hasn't seen her sister in several years and has never met the brother-in-law until now. Now, the rest of the movie is you finding out that
why
she ran away from this place, what this place really was. It was essentially a cult, even though there doesn't seem to be much of a religious aspect to it. It's more like a personality-driven sort of sex cult, that she's a part of.
Which is why everyone's so attractive.
With some organic farming thrown in. And also some really crazy other stuff. But, you know, like, she goes back to the house with her brother and sister and brother, or her sister and brother-in-law. And you know what? It's not so awesome there either, because they're both really, like, they lack all empathy, and he's hot-tempered, and they don't get what her problem is, and she doesn't want to talk about it, and she's got all this stuff that she's sort of burying because she doesn't want to face the stuff that she's been a part of, allowed to happen to her, allowed for herself to do to other people. And so as it unrolls in this very sort of detail-upon-detail way, it just becomes more and more tense and unnerving and unsettling and unhappy, and I just felt tight inside the whole
movie. You just feel like your spine is clenching up.
It's such a good film, and Elizabeth Olsen, is this her first movie?
Yeah.
Or really?
Okay. Yeah.
She's great. This is like the sort of Star Is Born kind of performance that you hear about sometimes that people do.
I had seen it.
I was experiencing her panic.
It really puts you in a vice. And I saw this movie at Sundance and had the same response you did. And then I went to see it again with you because I wanted to get it sort of be fresher on it before I wrote my review. And within the first 5 seconds, my whole body just went, like, it just, oh, I remember all this now.
Am I back seeing this movie?
Yes, but it's really, really good. And it's, you know, it's very Polanski-esque, I think so, from the way that it sort of just like kind of puts the tension on to the whole, the use of water and the boat, you know, all that kind of stuff. I mean, there's a lot of specific sort of motifs you could even point to. But yeah, Elizabeth Olsen, incredible performance. But also, I mean, you've got John Hawkes, you know, who's so good at that sort of charismatic, creepy, backwoods guy thing. Yeah. Brady Corbett, a really good actor who I never recognized from role to role, but who's always really interesting, who was in Mysterious Skin. He plays kind of the...
he's sort of the right-hand man.
Yeah,
he's John Hawkes.
He's sort of
John Hawkes sends him out to
He's the one who
to pimp the fresh young ladies.
Yeah, he brings the hotties into the fold, basically. Yeah. You know, Sarah Paulson is the sister, I think, is really good, and Hugh Dancy is the annoying brother-in-law. All very well acted. First time filmmaker, this writer-director Ryan Durkin, his first feature. This is a really assured film, and it's not
easy. Critic word.
Well, it's, you know, we're critics. Shut up. Anyway,
he knows, I just like to point him out when you use him.
He knows what he's doing. He's very, you know, he really knows how to sort of play the audience and sort of not manipulate you, but definitely kind of make you feel things in a certain way.
Now, I've read some negative reviews.
Well, they're wrong.
And one of them cites a thing that I think is sort of interesting.
What's that?
This is the thing we were talking about the other day. The critic, Manny Farber, old-timey
film critic. Oh, right, Manny Farber, right.
And his ideas about the sort of false profundity, the sort of flashy, you know, shininess of what was then sort of like the growing, you know, art house film. And
I don't think this is a movie that's trying to like bowl you over with its deep ideas or anything. I think it's very much just kind of it's a really cool character study.
Yeah. Well, he specifically calls this technique the GIMP, and it's based on what was apparently a real thing, and I'd have to go back and look this up myself, but apparently a real thing back in sort of Victorian society where women would have their skirts and petticoats attached. The hems would be attached to like these strings that would run all the way up, and they would have control of the string, and they would sort of pull the string so that, you know, a flash of ankle would, or petticoat would be visible to a man. And it's sort of like, you know, oh, did I just do that? You know, like this sort of, you know, I'm presenting something to you that you think is going to be something really big, but it's not really big at all. And the analog in film is, you know, check out my technique, and I've got real deep stuff to tell you, but I don't really have anything to tell you at all.
I don't think that applies to this at all.
Well, there have been some reviews that actually cited Manny Farber's GIMP idea.
Uh-huh.
And you know, they're interesting to read. You should go read them. I always love to read the negative reviews.
I don't think that this movie is not all flash and all technique at all.
I'm just saying that that's what's out there. And I you know, I'm willing to think about that. But I did, and then I thought to myself, no, I was truly, you know, I feel like that we live in a moment where, you know, where the emphasis, the sort of cultural, you know, fascination with cults was a few decades ago, but
yeah, after Jonestown and everything,
but the idea that one sort of extreme environment is much more different than any other kind of extreme environment, you know, and especially now that we've got like political candidates calling each other cult members and. Right. And you have this woman in this film who leaves one sort of unpleasant place and goes to another unpleasant place.
Right. Yeah. And it's not like, oh, she's rescued now. It's so, like, no, she's back to the family that she escaped before, because clearly this is not like the loving warmth of.
I like the ideas it brings up about who's got it worse.
Right.
whose ideas about life are weirder and stupider and more damaging.
I think it's a really great portrait of PTSD. Like,
also that.
Like, I could see for, say, a returning soldier from Iraq or Afghanistan, if they didn't want to watch something like The Hurt Locker because it was too close to their experience.
Too full of bombs.
No, but like that you could show them this movie and they could really sort of empathize with the whole notion of adjusting to life after.
How does this make you feel?
I'm just saying, you know, as a therapeutic exercise or whatever, you know, I think it's a really... You know, it really captures the whole sort of internal, you know, breakdown that she's going through.
Right.
And you know, the movie kind of plays up the idea of, you know, is she racked with paranoia or are the cult people coming after her?
Right.
And the thing is, and they make either plausible. So it, and they, but they don't, and they don't ever tip their hand as to which is true. So it, that's part of what makes the movie so, so tense, is that, that you don't really know, like,
right.
You know, what is she making this up or is this really happening kind of stuff. And not in a sort of showy, you know, way, but, you know, it's all there.
I agree. Three Musketeers. Why don't you why don't you talk about your personal feelings of the Three Musketeers?
So the Three Musketeers begins with like a jewel robbery caper kind of thing involving like somebody scuba diving. And I'm like, okay, I'm already out of this. What is going on in this stupid, stupid movie? Now, when I was a kid, my dad, for years, would bug me to read The Three Musketeers. And I was like, I don't want to. Finally, one summer, I don't know why, but I finally capitulated and read it. And I loved it. And like, I never wanted to read, you know, boys' adventures when I was a kid. I was, you know, catching up on my Judy Blume. But I really, really love The Three Musketeers. And it's a great story. And I really, really love Richard Lester's The Three Musketeers and The Four Musketeers in the early 70s, which really gets the tone right. Like, they're kind of bawdy, but they're also funny and they're adventurous. And, you know, they really just nail it. And all the other Three Musketeers, especially since then, you know, there was that awful one in the 90s with, you know, Charlie Sheen and Chris O'Donnell. It was just dopey. And then this one is so, like, trying to kind of ride the Pirates of the Caribbean coattails and be all sort of Matrix-y. And it's just terrible. I was in pretty much just agony from start to finish.
I was not in agony.
There's blimps that shoot fire in this movie, because, you know, that's what the Three Musketeers really needed. Blimps that shoot fire.
Okay. This movie has no reason to exist beyond the fact that it's a public domain property. You don't have to pay anybody to get it made. Yeah.
You can hire the guy who wrote Alien versus Predator.
Correct.
To poop all over it. Although the other co-writer, like, has written all this, like, sort of fancy British, you know, Jane Austen miniseries kind of stuff, and, like, the Bridget Jones Diaries movies.
Really?
Yeah. But I suspect, I sense more the hand of the Alien versus Predator writer myself.
So this movie has no reason to exist. But you could also say that the 1930 whatever version with singing Don Ameche and
the Ritz Brothers,
the Ritz Brothers had no reason to exist either.
Yeah, I suppose.
And so the Ritz Brothers, by the way, were sort of
vaudeville.
They were the Marx Brothers, but not as famous or as funny. I have a really hard time taking my job seriously when I go to see a movie like this, because I walk into the theater and I think to myself, okay, now I'm here to watch this movie and go home and write something about it. And I feel, you know, I don't call myself a real film critic most of the time. I know I wasn't really hired to be that guy. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I also feel a responsibility to not just be a thumb up or thumb down kind of, you know, machine, you know, like, it's just, don't waste your money. This is no good. You know, like, there, I want to feel like I'm telling you maybe the reason why this thing is even in the world when I'm writing about it. That's, mm-hmm, hopefully, you know, what I'm occasionally hitting. But when I see a movie like this, I realize that there's no way to do that. There's not a reason for this movie to exist. It's, you're not going to it for any reason other than you're bored, you're at the mall, and it's there, and it's, everything else is sold out, and you just want to sit down for a bit.
It's directed by Paul W.S. Anderson.
There's no. It doesn't have a point. So no. when I sit through it and I watch it and then I go write about it, I think, all right, did this make me angry? Did its existence make me angry? It did not. Is it stupid? Yes, it is completely stupid. Are there moments of pleasure, even if they're split seconds of pleasure? And yes, there are.
Apart from enjoying the cuteness of Ray Stevenson, I had no pleasure in this movie.
I tell you what I liked about Ray Stevenson. First of all, he's the Punisher. And so when I see him, I just think, the Punisher! And he's going to put his fist right through your skull. But here's what's great about Ray Stevenson in this movie. He's always giving the camera a look like, check out what movie I'm in. And then he does this, twirls his mustache. Like, he actually twirls his mustache like, that's right, I got a mustache, I'm twirling it, I'm in the Three Musketeers. Ha ha! That's what I liked about him. So I put that in my review. I was like, I liked it when Ray Stevenson twirled his mustache. I liked that Mila Jovovich had more action sequences than any of the Musketeers. She is married to the director. That's fascinating.
The very hacky Paul Anderson.
In one way, this is a movie about husbands directing wives.
Mm.
And there's so much of that in the history of movies.
Right.
That it's an idea that's fun to think about and look at, you know, stacked up next to movie.
But she's terrible in this.
Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter.
Orlando Bloom. Talk about mustache
twirling. Are all having a good time collecting their paycheck. I bet you this was a real happy cast. You know, like, I bet you they were all just sort of like, yeah, we're having fun. You know, like,
we're in France.
We're getting money and we're in France and they've got that great butter there. You know, because these, you know, the governmental food standards are so much stricter than the United States. You just eat everything that's so great.
All right.
And
can we
I
talk,
think they're having a good time.
Can we talk about Logan Lerman?
And I like that there are blimp battles. I like that there are flying pirate ships. I like that the craven greed and copycatishness of this film. The whole idea of, like, let's make it be as much like Pirates of the Caribbean as we can possibly make it. To that end, let's make sure there are pirate ships in the film. What will we do with them? I know. Attach them to blimps and put them in the air, and they will shoot cannons at each other, never hitting the other one's blimp portion.
Yeah, well, until it's finally necessary for the plot.
And so I liked that.
The movie opens when Logan Lerman
was not on the screen.
God, he's terrible.
I don't blame this kid. I think he, you know, will grow into whatever it is he's got for movies.
Playing a French swordsman, however,
it ain't this movie.
Is not in his skill set.
Sheesh. This is a terrible movie. Having said that, I ain't mad at it.
I'm mad at it. I had a terrible, terrible time. The movie opens with them stealing these Da Vinci plans for the flying warships, and I thought, oh, God, I'd rather be watching Hudson Hawk right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. And that's got Sandra Bernhard singing, I Got the Power.
Exactly. And yeah, Paul W.S. Anderson.
What movie has that?
Yeah.
Hudson Hawk, that's what movie.
W.S. Anderson started out as, like, a critically acclaimed filmmaker. We tend to forget at
this
point.
What happened?
Paul W.S. Anderson.
Started out as?
As a critically acclaimed filmmaker.
Or remind me which
he made a movie called Shopping.
That's right.
In 1995, about British kids
who steal cars
and drive them into the front windows of stores and steal stuff.
Well, he got tired of nobody seeing his movies. That's why.
And yeah, and then immediately became the biggest, like, hacky hackerstein video game adapting nothing director who just pumps out the.
Sometimes you just want to make some money.
Well, you know.
And I bet how many people saw Shopping outside of film festivals. How many people saw that?
Well, that's beside the point, though.
Well, it's part of the point. Weren't you just at an event? I'm not going to name the names of any of it. But weren't you just recently at an event where a person was given an award and And when he was given the award, he said, I'm not the kind of person that gets awards, and felt pretty grateful about it. But he knows who he is, and he knows what kind of movies he makes. He makes crappy movies, yes. But he makes crappy movies that make a lot of money.
But that's all he's ever made, though. Just because nobody.
All right, yes, that is also
just because nobody saw Shopping. That's like saying, oh well, sorry, Danny Boyle, nobody went to see Shallow Grave. So instead of making Trainspotting, why don't you make Resident Evil? No, that's not an excuse.
You have a point.
Thank you.
But sometimes you go for the money.
Well, he clearly has, and he married Mila Jovovich. And
sometimes you go for the money, and in the process of going for the money, you get to marry Mila Jovovich.
Now, didn't she used to be married to Luc Besson?
She might have been involved with him, but maybe not married to him.
Like, weren't they together when he cast her in that crazy Joan of Arc movie?
I'm going to Wikipedia her the same way that I have just Wikipedia'd
Maren Cadell.
Cadell. Who has Mila Jovovich been married to? That's a good question. Talk about something.
Anyway, here's the thing. Like, I mean, literally 2 weeks ago, I was saying how in Dirty Girl, Mila Jovovich gave what I think is probably her best performance so far. And then to see her in this being terrible again with her Dirty Girl co-star Juno Temple also miscast and terrible in this Three Musketeers movie. It was just kind of agonizing.
Blah, blah, blah.
But yeah, no, I just...
Music career... Fashion design, modeling.
The Three Musketeers was an unbearable experience. It's
Jovovich currently resides in homes in Los Angeles and New York with her husband, film writer and director Paul W.S. Anderson, whom she married on 22 August 2009. Blah, 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 Resident Evil. She was married to... Sean Andrews, I don't know who that is. She dated a guy from Jamiroquai.
We've all been there.
She was married to Luc Besson. And after their wedding, they went skydiving. And then they got divorced. Like a year later. And...
I can imagine
she dated John Frusciante from the Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Here's the divorce proceedings. Judge, Exhibit A, this crazy Joan of Arc movie. Divorce granted. Next case.
So yeah, she does a lot of things, and she's married several guys, and
she's a fashion designer.
And she's... Oh, no, she's got a... Like
she's got a line, really?
She has a popular line.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Did not I forget the name of it. But.
And she apparently complains on Twitter when she thinks that the distributor isn't doing enough to push the movie.
I mean, have you seen any of the Resident Evil movies?
No.
They are also garbage. However...
She commits to them?
However, she commits to them, and I have not... Again, they're terrible. I am mad at them. It might just be that Paul W.S. Anderson is the bad filmmaker that I walk out of those movies and I think, yeah, fine, whatever. Keep doing it.
You have a lot of those.
No, I don't.
You have Uwe Boll.
That's different. That's different. My devotion to Uwe Boll is enthusiasm. Uh-huh. Is enthusiasm based. I don't have a devotion to Paul W.S. Anderson. I walk out of Paul W.S. Anderson's movies and go, all right. It's okay.
What about Rod Lurie?
Fine. Rod Lurie is also different. He's different from Uwe Boll, but I have the same amount of enthusiasm for Rod Lurie because Rod Lurie makes the kind of like chest-beating, teeth-gnashing political thrillers that are all like, oh, the humanity, you know, like, and you get the feeling that he thinks he's got a whole lot of real deep things to say, but they are, his movies are dumb and yet completely thrillingly entertaining to watch because the actors are going for it in that acting
right
way. You know?
They all think they're going to be the next Joan Allen and get that Oscar nomination out of it.
Yeah, they're snarling and foaming at the mouth. And so that's different from an Uwe Boll movie. Because an Uwe Boll movie has, you know, sexy ninja wood nymphs. You know, battling in medieval times against, you know, Burt Reynolds. And that's a whole other level.
And really, you're just hoping that Nicolas Cage will work with any of these directors.
Yeah, that's a whole other level of stuff. Like, there are bad filmmakers who I really love, like Uwe Boll and Rod Lurie, for specific reasons. Paul W.S. Anderson is not that guy. Paul W.S. Anderson is that guy that I walk in the movie, I watch it, I walk out, and I say, I got to eat a pretzel while I was watching that, and there were some blimps. And Mila Jovovich did that cool sort of like limbo slide while the phantasm balls whizzed around her head. That's not bad. I'm not angry when
it was driving up the wall how this movie was trying to recast current action movie cliches in like 18th century style.
I don't mind
like,
that either.
So like
doesn't bother me.
So
at all.
Like when Mila Jovovich has to go to get the jewels, and you know instead of having the laser beams going in a million directions, she has to leap through them like Catwoman. It's like I guess invisible razor wire or something.
No. It's invisible laser beams, and she throws this dust.
No, they're
in the air.
Sweetie, they're not laser beams. I figured it had to be invisible razor wire.
You called me sweetie just now. We're in love. Anyway,
this movie is garbage.
Yeah, we don't have to talk about it anymore.
Fine, let's not. Okay, we've gotten up to the Paranormal Activity 3 section of the program.
Okay. The way we need to work this is you need to talk and finish what you want to say, and then let me talk and finish what I want to say. Okay. Because to have an argument about this
would be to get into details.
Will be not only to get into details, but it will be pointless because it's not like I'm going to convince you of anything.
No, right.
But we have different perspectives.
Right. We come at this from a different way,
and yours is wrong, and that's why I think you should talk first so that I get to have the final say.
Fine. You live for this.
Begin.
You're a sap. Anyway, so here's the thing. I didn't see...
You can't call me sweetie and then call me a sap within 2 minutes of time. Because remember, we're in love.
Have we not met? Have I not been doing this to you for the last decade and a half? Now we're changing the rules?
Talk about the movie.
Okay. So here's the thing. I did not see either of the first two Paranormal Activities in the theater. And I didn't have to because I wasn't reviewing them. But I had to review Paranormal Activity 3. So,
and you generally won't go out of your way to watch horror.
Generally, no. Yeah, not really a genre I care about. I mean, there are some that I like. But, you know, I'm not going to see just any old thing if I don't have to. So we watched... the first two on Netflix. Now, I loved The Blair Witch Project when it came out. I saw it at Sundance, and I saw it again in the theater, and both times I thought it was scary, and it really worked. And I get how it's one thing to see something that's all handheld video and, you know, supposed to be real when it's on the big screen and you're in a darkened theater. And then when you watch, I remember watching about 2 seconds of The Blair Witch Project on DVD and going, oh, no, this looks wrong, this looks stupid, you know, because it just looked like somebody's crappy home movie footage or something. So I totally get that the reason that I am not down for the Paranormal Activity series is because I didn't see 1 and 2 in the theater. And so watching them on TV, they just look cheesy and stupid and boring and slow and whatever. So I went into 3 being all like, yeah, whatever, what do you got? And I found it, for the most part, to be cheesy and boring and stupid and slow, except for there are, like, 2 or 3 really good scares, like, in the last 40 minutes. But you still have to sit through the first 40 minutes to get to them. So this one's a prequel, and it's basically about the sisters and the aforementioned thing in their
it's
house.
It's another prequel.
Right. It's a pre-prequel.
Yeah.
You know, because...
Second one was a prequel, too.
Second one was a prequel by, like, a matter of months or something. But this one goes back to 1988, right. And it's about the thing, the invisible boogeyman guy in their bedroom, and, you know, how it all began. And, of course, they don't remember it, but it's on these VHS tapes that have disappeared, but then we get to somehow see what's on them anyway. And I guess if you're... like Dave White and like these movies, you will like this one too. If you are not and have never been, then you probably won't. And even if you do like him, you may, by movie three, decide that you've seen all the tricks in this bag and you're done. But that's up to you. That's it. That's all I got.
The end. Okay.
Wrong! See what I did there?
I wish that you had seen the first one with me the week before it opened, which is how I saw it. Paramount had not opened it in any theaters yet. And they were showing, and I remember they were giving us a really hard time about seeing it at all.
Because they were doing that whole, you know, vote to bring it to
your
town.
They were teasing us. Like, I remember being, I don't know if I've got my details. I don't have the facts to back this up. My memory of this, of the week up to the screening of the first one, was that I was asking some publicists and they were like, well, we don't know if it's coming to Los Angeles. Like it was the whole game of clap for Tinkerbell or she'll die. You know, like that you've got to vote to get the movie to come to your town. It was right. Brilliant and completely fake. And, but I remember going, you know, well, I mean, are you going to show this movie to the press before the first opening markets, regardless of whether or not they are Los Angeles, and I, as I am a film critic, can I see your movie?
Yeah, because you're a national film critic who so didn't open here. You know.
Right, exactly. And so, so eventually, I get an invitation to come see it. There's a press screening at midnight. That never happens. That's outlandish. Like that's not a thing that you do. Ever. So again, they're upping the ante on how much can they mess with your head before you even get a chance to see this sort of like movie that's building a little bit of buzz of, as being something strange and new and unique, you know? And I was like, all right, I have to do this. Now you're my bedtime is like 9:30. I go to bed and I was grumbling and resentful that I had to stay up until midnight to watch this. But I went, and I didn't know a thing about it, and nobody had told me a thing about it, and it hadn't opened in theaters yet. Excuse me.
Sorry.
Totally scary. Totally scary, because the repetitive quality of it meant that all you got was this one shot that they would return to again and again and again. Of long dark hallway, and something is down the long dark hallway, and you don't know what's down the long dark hallway, and you don't know, in spite of what Katie, the woman in the first movie, says about, oh, I think I've had a ghost my whole life haunting me, and it follows me from place to place. You don't know if she's saying it right. Like, you don't know if she's remembering it properly, or if in fact it is specific to her or the house. It feels very much like a what's in the house kind of movie. And that's terrifying. You know, like, what are those creaky noises? Why are lights turning on and off in the middle of the night?
Who moved the car keys?
Down the hall. Like, it's not just like in your room, but like down the hall, click, click. And that's it. And so by building that up over the course of the movie and that repetitive quality, it builds serious dread and tension because you don't know what's going on. You don't know what's happening. And then you find out at the end. What I didn't like about part two is that it expanded the scope and gave you more camera angles, a bigger house, more opportunity, in spite of the fact that we now realize that it is something that haunts a specific person. Both of these movies, and even this third one, still has the feel of a haunted house movie and not a haunted person movie. And so
it's not the house.
Because it's haunted. It's affecting everyone in the house. So technically, it's a haunted house movie. And so because of that, there were many more opportunities for you to be like, well, could y'all just leave? Y'all could just go. The brilliant quality of the first one is that the camera is pushed back against a wall in a room with no escape. The only escape is through the door, and out that door is the scary, terrifying thing that's coming down the hall. So in the other movie, it's sort of like, well, there's a big window right there. You could just get out of the house. Look, just there it is. Leave. Go out the window. Get away from whatever it is. Leave the house. And so it didn't, and it was a lot more of the same. Now, in the second movie, they give you more mythology of what this is, what this means, and who it's coming through, and where it's going, and why, and how they're going to transfer it to one person or the other, sort of like a game of like demon hot potato, but
or the ring,
yeah, and now part three, I was not enthusiastic at all about part three because part two sort of let me down. I just was like, you just gave me a little more of the same, but bigger in part two. What I love about this one, part three, is that they know that all they have left, because now if you've been paying attention and watching the stories, you know what the story is, you know what the rules are, essentially, and you know what happens in the future. So now they're going to come back and tell you what happened in the past. So there's no mystery left as to what this thing is and what's going on in the house and what's going to happen to these people 20 years in the future. What all they have is the jolts and hopefully the ability to build tension for those jolts. And they do it in, I gotta say, I felt a really inventive, low-tech, fun way with a friggin' oscillating fan of all things.
Yeah, no, that's what the movie's best idea.
And there are some great jolts, some very surprising visual moments. All the effects are total practical effects, with the exception of maybe one. And the one that isn't, I think, a total practical effect is completely shocking and makes you feel like, oh my God, like what's happening to this person? I had a really good time. I don't know where they can take it now.
More backstory, I suppose.
I don't know where they can take it now. I'm willing to watch a part four if they've got something to tell me, if they've got something really inventive to part me, but I'm back on board now.
Well, whether or not they have anything to say, there's going to be a part four.
I'm back on board now
These movies cost 2 cents and they make like hundreds of millions of dollars worldwide.
I will also say that the 80s details are pretty good.
Yeah.
They're not...
They're not House of the Devil good?
They're not House of the Devil good. Because there are, bless you, there are occasional moments where I am detecting compromises in things like hair and clothing, which that's the least necessary of a thing to screw with. Yeah. Like, you could go out and get that stuff. The hard thing is to make a set look like it's really from the 80s. Right. The hard thing is to get a location that looks like it's really from the 80s. If you can't do hair and makeup right and clothing right, then you got no business making a movie set in the 80s. And that's, if I have a detail-oriented beef with this movie being set in 1988, it's that the people don't exactly look like they should be in 1988. They look like, well, we're not going to distract you with them having dumb mall hair,
right,
or acid wash jeans. We're going to let them look fairly generic in a 2011 I remember the 80s sort of way.
Right.
You watch House of the Devil and everything in that movie looks like it was genuinely made in the 80s. I just started watching it again yesterday on Netflix, and just cuz I love that movie and it's so much fun. But the 80s details in House of the Devil are fantastic. And they're good in this one. The sets are really great. Like that 80s house that they live in.
Yeah.
With the black lacquer orb lamp on the, you know, just everything about it looks kind of peach.
Yeah, that salmon-y.
Terrible. Totally. But yeah, no, it's good looking on that level.
Fair enough. I'm perfectly willing to admit that had I seen the first two movies the way that I should have, you know.
And I think these movies capture a national mood better than Margin Call does, because I think these movies are genuinely haunted house movies and about the idea of the house that eats you alive. And
that's
and
a stretch.
I don't think it's a stretch. I don't think the directors intended this. Obviously, I'm not saying this is my statement about the banking industry. But I think that the mood of the country is, yeah, it sucks to be in my house because I'm going to lose it and it's all going to fall down around me.
Also, because these are horror movies.
And so the anxiety that you feel about real life gets to be cathartically experienced in
the theater.
These are
horror movies in which you can't do anything about the situation.
Right.
You know, or you choose not. Like, you know, nobody calls the demonologist in the first one, you know, until it's too late and then they can't get him
on the
phone.
He's on vacation.
Yeah, you know. It's like, you're just like,
he's
sorry.
Demon Disneyland.
You've got this thing in your house and you're too bad.
No, I don't think these movies are intentionally about
that. No, I
agree. But I think that horror films reflect the anxieties of the world
around
them.
Yeah, no.
And that's what I think goes on. Letters.
Letters. We have letters.
People wrote us letters. And Alonso printed them out.
Yes.
And he wants to read them.
I'm going
to
read letters this week because I'm thinking that maybe if I do that, we'll get more of them in the future. So,
because we love being loved.
We do. This is from Evan D. He says, "Dear Linoleum Knifers, I've recently discovered your podcast through the What the Flick show and have spent the last week and a half working my way through the entire back catalog. I promise this is less creepy than it may seem. As a recent graduate from the University of Washington with a degree in philosophy, I am currently employed loading heavy boxes into dank trailers at our local UPS hub for near minimum wage."
I used to do that.
Yeah.
I loaded a UPS truck all summer for the Horchow collection in Dallas.
The only
wonder if they still exist.
Wikium.
Keep reading.
"The only aspect of my job which keeps the Sisyphean banality of my back-breaking labor..." Now, there's a college graduate. Sisyphean banality.
Right.
"...of my back-breaking labor from driving me mad is the multitude of podcasts I listen to on a daily basis. Linoleum Knife has quickly skyrocketed to the top of my queue and has led me to raiding my Netflix account and local library DVD racks in search of the lively, interesting, and strange films which I've been missing out on my whole life. I wish I had something more stimulating or enlightening to share, but all I can offer is my sincere thank you for the hours of free entertainment you two have supplied me. You've made one disgruntled 23-year-old Teamster's life a little more bearable. Keep up the great work."
He's a Teamster?
Apparently.
Well, then he's not. Then he's making union money.
He says near minimum wage.
Hmm.
Unions don't have the pull they used to, but I
suppose you're right.
I'm glad you're in one. Thank you, Evan. We appreciate that. Chris R., who is not Chris R. from The Room... says, "I have to admit, I was hoping that Butter Burgers also contained a pat of butter on the inside that melted into the meat."
They could if you wanted them to. You could put that. You could do that.
He says, "If when I make them, I think I will wrap the patty around a pat of butter to investigate its flavor-enhancing potential. I really like the longer format of the recent podcast, and I love to hear about independent movies and those movies just out of the mainstream. I also love when you guys rip into a bad movie, and I share your love of good trash. I also enjoy the funny and interesting tidbits about directors and actors, short lessons in cinematic history, and the tales of your movie-reviewing adventures. The story about the woman with no inside voice had me giggling out loud in my office. One suggestion for your show is adding a Netflix pick or other streaming service pick to your show in addition to your DVD picks."
I don't know that that's a good idea.
I've not really been able to find a good source that collates...
People already think that we're sponsored by Netflix.
Okay.
And until we actually are getting something out of it...
Okay, but here he goes, "I've not really been able to find a good source that collates new and worthwhile additions to Netflix. Do you guys know of any sites that do this?" I do, actually.
Oh, yeah?
There's a site called, it's a blog called hackingnetflix.com. And not hacking in the, like, they're trying to interrupt it or say way. But every week they post a thing of what are the new movies being added to the streaming lineup. This week, for example, Bertrand Tavernier's Princess of Montpensier was just added to the streaming lineup.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, good, because I've been saving that DVD all year. I was going to sit down at the end of the year when I have a... free time to watch a French historical drama.
Right.
Just for my own pleasure.
Now it's on Netflix.
But now I can do it with the click of my remote.
Chris
Thanks, Netflix.
Chris R.
Sponsor our show.
Please. Chris R. also says, "Oh, I also share Dave's love of all things Nicolas Cage and have made similar tirades extolling the quirky greatness he brings to SE movies to many of my friends."
You're correct about Nicolas Cage.
Thanks so much for the podcast and all of your great reviews elsewhere online, Chris.
The Horchow Collection is real still. They still exist.
Okay.
I worked for them in 1984, loading a UPS truck in a non-air-conditioned warehouse in Dallas, Texas.
Is that the one where
in the summertime?
Where you talked about like taking hot showers afterwards and black snot would come out of your mouth from all the your nose from all the dust?
No.
No?
What are you talking about?
Somebody told me this story. I thought it was you.
That wasn't me.
Somebody worked some job where it was so dusty and gross that when, after work they would take these hot showers and they would like blow their nose and just all this black gunk would come out.
I'll tell you, the one time that did happen to me when I had black gunk coming out of my nose, the 6 months I lived in London.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Like so sooty and so gross. The air, so sooty and so gross. Just like at the end of the day, I'd shower and I'm just like,
it's because Dick Van Dyke's going around sweeping all those chimneys.
Boy, governor. Yeah, he was. That's what was happening. I was a chimney sweep.
Ah, well, that explains it all. Katie.
Getting stuck.
Katie.
In every chimney.
Katie D writes, "Hey guys, just want to let you know I think you're amazing and tell all my friends to listen to you, and I know at least one has taken me up on it. I also wanted to say that you were both right about 13
you're
assassins.
Not working hard enough to get more people on board then.
Look, she's doing more than most.
Do better.
You were both right about 13 assassins being totally great. Why can't all fight sequences be shot in such a clear and easy to follow and super exciting way? Why indeed?
And why can't there be more total massacres?
Exactly. I don't think you've ever mentioned it on the show, so I'll ask, did you guys see The Good, The Bad, The Weird? It was probably one of my top five movies from last year. Delightful. Keep up the great work, Katie. I didn't see it either, Katie, but we'll try and check it out. Bill W., we are friends of Bill W., apparently, says, I'm a bit behind. I'm with Alonzo on the songs from movies thing. I'm in a relationship where my other half could tell you the name of any song from the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, if it's British, in two notes or less. When I do listen to music, it's a very narrow list, like The Cure, The Cult, Metallica, Soundgarden, Devo. But since I don't really listen to music, I don't have a memory to attach to it. Music in movies is where I get that, and the time when the movies came out affects my like for it. My best example is the song Little Heaven by Toad the Wet Sprocket. Decent band. I don't own a record of theirs, as I'm not super into them. However, I could listen to Little Heaven forever because of the prom scene in Buffy the Vampire Slayer, which came out summer before my senior year in high school. There are a number of songs from movies that I like more than I normally would, simply because they're associated movie. I smell an Ellen segment.
You smell an Ellen
segment? I think he means LK, a linoleum knife segment.
I want to start spelling knife with an N. NYFE.
And
knife.
One more. Brandon G. writes, hey guys, I love your show. It always makes my Monday mornings better. How do you guys feel about trailers that give the movie away? I've been adamantly avoiding the trailer for The Thing because it shows the people who've turned into The Thing, and that ruins the whole mystery of who is still human.
That trailer doesn't show everybody who turns into The
all,
Thing.
All my friends make fun of me when the trailer comes on and I cover my eyes and start to hum.
I don't really care.
Trailers, but they do.
I've gotten to where I don't care anymore.
They bug me.
I'll watch them. I won't watch them. It doesn't matter.
I'll still look at them, but I
and part sometimes, like in Paranormal Activity 3, there's nothing in the trailer that's even in the movie.
Yeah, no kidding.
You don't have a damn thing in that trailer that's in the film, pretty much, except the kid bouncing on a trampoline.
Part of me wants to do what Ebert says Siskel used to do, which was to literally like either leave the theater or just cover his eyes and ears and hum. Because, it's gotten to where they, when you look at most of the movies that get made now, they're based on... they're selling familiarity because they're either sequels or they're reboots or they're based on TV shows or they're based on comic books or whatever. And so it feels like with trailers, if it's a new concept, they want it to be familiar to you by the time you get into the theater. So they just tell you all three acts of what happens. I mean, like I remember the Larry Crown trailer this summer being like, oh my God, I've just seen the entire movie. And I read somewhere that apparently with movies that are targeted at women, they do that even more. I don't know what that means.
Yeah, I don't know what that means.
Although, sometimes I get surprised by the fact that, like, I had seen the play Farragut North, and then when I saw the trailer for The Ides of March, I was like, oh my gosh, they're giving away the whole story. But as it turns out, no, they're giving away the whole story of the play, but the movie had, other, more paths to follow. So it didn't spoil the whole thing. So, yeah, generally speaking, I prefer certain movies I won't even see the trailer at all. I'll try to avoid it. But, it's just we're stuck with them. So, yeah, if you want to cover your eyes and hum, I think that's a wise move probably.
I just don't care anymore about trailers. Like, show me them, don't show me them. I'll watch vintage trailers
all
day long.
Those are great.
And
sometimes I'll even go back after seeing the movie, if I didn't see the trailer beforehand, and see the trailer just to see how they're selling it and how much they're spoiling in advance,
Right.
But yeah, I would just as soon not know if given the option.
They're not
all things.
They don't wreck my experience.
Okay.
Yeah, that's it.
All right. This brings us to an end of another episode.
Did we not DVD recommend?
Oh, right. Sorry. Goodness. What do you got?
Well, this isn't a recommendation, but I plan to watch a Serbian film this week for the first time.
Oh, okay.
It is finally out on American DVD and apparently uncensored.
Ugh.
And I've been wanting to see this ever since I read the first horrifying reviews out of South by Southwest.
Was it South by Southwest or Fantastic Fest? It was South by Southwest. You're right, yeah.
And I know some people who have already seen it, and the responses have ranged from, you will never get that part of your brain back again, to, it looked fake, to, I laughed all the way through it. So, like...
Why don't you explain what a Serbian film is?
It is a horror slash torture slash, according to the filmmakers, political drama. Not satire, but drama. A political sort of allegory about the Serbian, you know, Bosnian conflict, war, genocide, massacre, blah, blah, everything. I don't mean to minimize it by saying blah, blah. That was just a...
You ran out of vocabulary.
Sorry, Serbian people. but apparently it is literally about that, or figuratively about that. I shouldn't even say literally, but it concerns a former porn star who's fallen on hard times and cannot provide for his wife and child or children. I don't remember how many kids he's supposed to have in the movie. And he is given the opportunity to come be in a pornographic art film for a lot of money that will help him take care of his family. Then he learns that not only is it not a art film, it's a snuff movie, and he has to participate in the sexual murders of a lot of different people, ranging in age.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And
I'm not watching this. You can tell us all about it next week.
And who... And he's trapped. Like, the people involved, apparently, if I'm getting the plot details that I've heard of correctly, they're going to kill his family if he doesn't participate and go commit these atrocities on camera with his penis. And so, so I've been fascinated by the idea of this extremely, you know, difficult, ugly movie because everyone keeps talking about it. And now it's out on DVD. So I'm going to watch it this week, and I'll report back. So who knows?
Maybe I will even try and watch it.
You're not going to try and watch it.
Well, look, you know, I saw...
You are not going to try and watch it.
I mean, I was thinking about it. It's like, I used to go see things like Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer and stuff. I can't be this squeamish. I need to know about what's going on in... cinema.
The reactions among critics vary,
right?
As well, to this isn't the political movie that the filmmaker says it is. It's simply an exercise in disgust.
Yeah.
I
feel like I should perhaps have.
It's been banned in many countries because it portrays the basically the brutal sexual murder of
minors.
Yeah. And I don't know how much it portrays this. I don't know, really. I just know what I hear.
Right.
And so I'm interested to see if any of this makes sense in a real way.
All right.
Yeah.
Well,
I'll watch it. I'll tell you. And then you can go, I don't want you watching it with me.
Well, no, I don't want that either.
Yeah.
My recommendation this week is a movie that's coming out this Tuesday that is one of my favorite films of the year. Attack the Block.
Oh, yeah, that's great.
Did we review that on this show?
I think we did. It's a great movie.
Anyway, it's great. It's great. It's great. It's great. It's exciting, and it's funny, and it's smart, and it's, you know, makes the most out of a low budget, and it's creative. And the guy who wrote it and directed it is now, like, in the big time. I think he has a co-writing credit on the Tintin movie.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Joe Cornish. The film's, you know, executive produced by Edgar Wright. Nick Frost has a supporting role in it. But it's just, great. And now that it's on DVD, you can turn the subtitles on and you can understand what all the South London thuggy kids are saying because they have accents that are thicker than Marmite.
Right.
So that's my pick this week. We thank you for listening. And of course, you can join us. Join the
Marmite is a fermented yeast extract that people spread on toast.
Are you in a Bing commercial?
Mm. Have you ever eaten Marmite?
Never. No, I had a bite once. It was nasty.
It is so gross.
I'm sure the Brits will write in and tell us.
Do you know who loves it? Paul. Well, he likes Vegemite because he's from Australia.
Well, Australians, yeah.
But he was telling me all about, oh, I love Vegemite. And I'm like, you're disgusting.
Look, you grow up eating something, you can't be judged for that. It's just, it's hardwired into you.
It makes me want to, you know, I was looking at one of my cookbooks this past week. And there's a recipe in one of the Nigella Lawson books for spaghetti with Marmite. And it makes it,
ew.
The way she writes about it, of course.
Well, it makes it sound delicious.
She writes about everything so seductively.
Yeah.
Makes it sound delicious. Like, it makes me want to go buy a jar of Marmite and because it's right across the street. Gelson's carries it.
Yeah.
Makes me want to buy a jar of Marmite and try it again. Like, it's been 20 years. Yeah. I'd give it a taste again.
You know,
again.
If Nigella says
it seems disgusting, and I remember it being hideous, but... Yeah.
What else is in it besides... What do you put on the spaghetti besides the Marmite?
What do you put on what the spaghetti?
Yeah, what else is in this recipe?
I'd have to go look at the... Okay. I'd have to go look at the recipe.
All right. Anyway, if you too would like to have your listener mail read on the air and share your opinions or questions or whatever,
mentioned by name.
Drop us a line at linoleumpodcast, that's all one word, at gmail.com. You can like us on Facebook, the Linoleum Knife Podcast page. We are LinoleumCast on Twitter. And you can check into us on Get Glue. Although we're under TV shows for no apparent reason. I got to find out if we can get that fixed. But anyway, lots of fans of the show have been checking in there, and we appreciate it. I wonder if we could get stickers. I wonder how that works.
What are you talking about?
You know how on Get Glue, when you check into certain things, you get those stickers.
Again with the Get Glue. I don't care about Get Glue.
I mean, you put my stickers on your computer, so.
Well, you know why? I put you sent away for the actual physical stickers.
Because you made me do it.
That Get Glue provides.
Yes.
And they sent you two amazing ones. They sent you one of Mary-Kate Olsen from Beastly as the spooky goth witch. And they sent you one of Madea. So I put those on my laptop.
Well, so quit.
Because I liked Mary.
So quit complaining.
Mary-Kate was the only good thing about Beastly. And everybody loves Madea.
So quit complaining about Get Glue. You've benefited from them.
I guess I have.
Thanks,
Get Glue, for the Mary-Kate Olsen and Madea stickers.
Check out our friends elsewhere in the podcast universe, Popcorn Mafia with Gray Drake, The Comedy Couch with Dennis Hensley and Tony Tripoli, Blowhard with Malcolm Ingram, The Podcast, The Criterion Cast, Fat Guys of the Movies, Secretly Timid, who mentioned Dave this week talking about work of art.
I got mentioned on the show.
Yes, they were worried they defended you somehow, but I'm sure you did. They didn't.
No.
Yeah, I didn't think so.
You can't offend me.
No, that's the thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
And glitter in the garbage. What else? Anything else we need to plug? Pick up our
friend. Your book.
Oh, well, yes.
It's fixing to be Christmas time. And all the Christmas decorations are already up in the stores, or else they're about to be. By the end of October, they're up.
Yeah, except at Bloomingdale's.
It's fixing to be time to
shop.
Bloomingdale's?
Bloomingdale's is being, they decided.
So is Nordstrom.
Not till after Thanksgiving?
Nordstrom's not putting theirs up till after Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
I don't like that.
I want them up early.
I want Christmas stuff up in October before Halloween.
Yeah.
I want that. I want the jumble of holidays to all just sort of be
the nightmare before Christmas
happening. Yeah. And so begin thinking about buying Alonzo Duralde's book, Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas. You can even have a signed copy by Alonzo Duralde yourself if you pay for it via his PayPal, and he'll send it right to you with a signing in it. And won't that be exciting for you? I believe it's time for you to start thinking about buying Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas. I'm going to say this every week until Christmas. You know why? Because Christmas is about money and presents. And if you love Alonzo Duralde and Dave White and Linoleum Knife, you will buy Alonzo Duralde's book, Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas. What is it, $20?
Something like that.
Yeah.
So yeah, if you want to order,
what else are you going to do with $20? Go see Three Musketeers in 3D. That whole ticket will cost you about $20.
If you want to order a signed copy directly from us, drop us a line at Linoleum Knife, and we'll give you all the information that you need.
That's right.
To do that. And yeah, so that's coming up, and our DVD of Cage Men is out in November. And if you're in LA on Friday, December 2nd, is it the 2nd?
I don't remember.
Yes, Friday, December 2nd. I will be hosting a double feature of two cool, rare Christmas movies not on DVD at the Arrow Theater with the American Cinematheque, so check that out. And yeah, other exciting Christmas news coming up soon, so stick around for that. Thank you for listening. Tell your friends. Leave us a nice review on iTunes, and we will catch you next time.
Bye.